So what is at the center of your business? What's the core opportunity? You're about to create your franchise prototype. Now understand this. You're about to franchise your business. And franchising means you have an idea that distinguishes, that you own, that's proprietary, that distinguishes your business over everyone else's. You're pressed against that entrepreneurial question. You're pressed against that entrepreneurial question. What does your business need to look like when it's finally done? Can't depend upon you, obviously. You're not going to be out there delivering pizzas every 30 minutes. You go crazy. You can't do that. It can't depend upon you. Federal Express doesn't depend upon Fred Smith. Walt Disney's Disneyland didn't depend upon Walt. Walt wasn't there. Greeting people at the gate, for God's sakes, taking them on a ride. You say, yeah, but that's Disney. I'm saying, forget it. What is the opportunity in accountancy? What's the opportunity in a legal firm? What's the opportunity in a dress shop and a barber shop? Anybody here Supercuts? Anybody know about that business? Talk about an extraordinary business. I know the guy. His office is about four blocks from my office. Guy's a truck driver. I swear to God, the guy's a truck driver. He told me the story of how he created Supercuts. Supercuts is a very, very large franchise in the United States. The guy was a truck driver. He told me he was on drugs. He was a drunk. He was sitting in a bar one day, and he was disappointed in his life. He was 37 years old, and somebody said, you know something? He said, you're not going to believe this, but I'd recommend you do something that a friend of mine did. I'd recommend you go to beauty college. Swear to God. I'm telling you, this is a true story. I had a friend who went to beauty college, got a great job, loves what he does. So this guy, the founder of Supercuts, said, I'll do it. What the hell do I have to lose? So he decided to go to beauty college, and he did. He's the only guy in, well, the only guy, I mean, it's the only guy his age, 6'4", in a beauty college. And he's studying, he's really getting into this stuff. He never really was very good at what he was doing. He's about getting ready to graduate, and the owner of the beauty college comes over to him and says, and I'll call him Jim. He said, Jim, come on, I want to take you for a ride. And he says, come with me. So he gets in the guy's car, and they start driving around, and he starts showing Jim places that he owns. He's got this beauty college, and he's got a beauty college across the bay, and then the boutiques that he has, the salons that he has, and he starts showing them this little empire, and he said, you're never going to believe how I got started doing this. He said, I was a machinist. And somebody came to me one day and said, have you ever thought of going to beauty college? And he said, I did. He said, you can't believe the opportunity in this business. He said, any dummy can do this. And Jim said, it hit me in that moment. He said, I saw an opportunity. He said, I saw an opportunity to do something that had never been done. He said, I saw an opportunity to teach unskilled people how to cut hair at low cost to the consumer and very high profit to the owner. And I set about the task of building that system. Then it became the Supercut system. An absolutely turnkey way to cut hair. He sold the business when he sold his equity in the business. He got over $6 million for it. And he got that about 4.5 years after he created the idea. And after he had franchised it and sold 100 franchises. And the people who were buying those franchises were accountants, not barbers, not beauticians, because the business works in the hands of novices with absolutely no experience whatsoever. A low-cost, high-impact, absolutely professional, predictable haircut for men and for women for only $7. In a world in which they are paying 18 and 20 with great unpredictability, and you could do it in exactly 15 minutes. Now you say that's impossible, and I'm saying they did it. A turnkey system. Did he go and cut hair? Never did. He created a system because he saw an opportunity to do something that had not been done. So my question is, what's the opportunity in your business? And your strategic objective needs to reflect that answer. Your answer to that opportunity will serve not only as an opportunity for your customer, but also as an opportunity for everyone else who's doing business with your business. In the case of Supercuts, it meant that novices could get a job making good money doing something they love to do without extraordinary experience. They literally teach people, kids, how to cut hair and produce a professional result in an intensive training program that takes only 2 weeks. Did it work? Without a doubt. There are now over, I believe now, 3,000 Supercuts in the U.S. Each of them making more money than most businesses in this room. A simple idea. What's the idea behind your business? That's the question.
At this point in the seminar, Michael has the participants pair up for an exercise where one describes his or her business or business idea to the other. The other then responds by describing all the frustrations he's had or believes he would have when dealing with someone in that business. They then switch roles to identify the key frustrations people experience when dealing with the other's kind of business.
Now I want you to ask the question, the same question, from the perspective of an employee. What are the key frustrations of your people to work in a business like yours? You know what the key frustrations are. What are the things that drive your people nuts in your business? You understand what I'm saying? Now what I'd like you to think about, in order to organize all the things you've just been doing, is I'd like you to think about it all in the context of the four categories of preference that we've talked about. And the four categories of preference are visual preferences, emotional preferences, functional preferences, and financial preferences. And if you look at everything you've written down, every frustration, you'll see that those frustrations are tied to either visual, emotional, functional, or financial realities. And so you can begin to see, create a matrix of this for each and every one of your four primary influencers. And talk about their key visual frustrations, their key emotional frustrations, their key financial frustrations, and their key functional frustrations. And you can begin to identify those and narrow them down to the point where you have the primary frustrations that each and every one of these primary influencers experience on a day-to-day basis in a place like yours, in the industry such as yours, etc. and so forth. And that then becomes the opportunity for differentiation. The opportunity for differentiation becomes, how do I then eliminate those key frustrations, visual, emotional, functional, and financial, in my business systemically in order to produce exactly the opposite experience for each and every one of those four primary influencers when they come into contact with my business? So you can see it's almost a mechanical process of selectively going into the world and choosing those truly powerful, those potently powerful opportunities that you have in your business to transform your business so that it is perceived by the people you come into contact with as preferentially unique. So, for example, that mechanics would prefer to work in your auto repair business than any other auto repair business. They'd be waiting in line. So that, for example, attorneys would prefer to work in your legal firm than any other legal firm. They'd be waiting in line. What is it that you have to do in order to establish that position in the mind of your selectively, intentionally chosen customer, that central demographic model that I talked about earlier today? that central demographic consumer, that central demographic employee, that central demographic supplier, that central demographic lender, what do you have to do in your business to structurally operate your business in such a way that it says to them what they need to hear? And it can repeat it and repeat it and repeat it at will. So that's the idea behind your strategic objective. Now, where are you going to be? How many of those are you going to have? What is your business going to look like when it's finally done? Good. Good. So that's the question. That's your strategic objective. That's the mission. That's the entrepreneurial opportunity. You see then that in order for your business to be differentiated, it has to do something faster, or it has to do something easier, or it has to do something less expensively, or it has to do something better, or it has to do something more sensitively, etc. and so forth. In other words, in some way, operationally, your business has to be able to produce an impact that is quantifiably better, quantifiably less expensive, quantifiably more predictable, quantifiably, etc. and so forth, and qualitatively, experientially, more powerful than anybody else's business. And it has to be done in very specific, concrete ways so that people can point to them. So when I pointed to that hotel and I talked about the experience that I'd had there, I could talk about it in very, very concrete experiences. If they are not concrete experiences, or they are not specific things that you do with intention, with an understanding of the impact that those things are having, then they're of absolutely no value. Let me give you an experience. I got here on Tuesday afternoon. We checked in, and when I got here, I was really feeling under the weather. I mean, this cold was really getting me down, and my voice had gone. So I had no voice, and I had this, whatever I had, this pain in my chest, you know, breathing and all that, you know, and who knows what it is. Read about speakers dying on the road all the time, you know. You don't, but speakers do, you know what I'm saying? I mean, people who go to these events never read about it, but I read about every one of them, you know what I mean? You know, they asked me, would I like to go out to dinner? I said, no, guys, look, I gotta really rest, because if I'm going to have a voice on Friday, I got to do something. So I had seen a doctor, and she gave me an antibiotic and so forth. And so on, as I get all this medicine, and then they load me down with stuff to take for my throat and stuff to take for my nose and stuff to take, you know. And I got a load of stuff, and I bring it to the hotel, and I put it in my room, and I just lay down, and I try to go to sleep, and I can't go to sleep. And I got this thing that's blowing out steam in the room. I put do not disturb on the door so nobody disturbs me. And then all day the next day, you know, I'm just out of it. And do not disturb is on the thing. And occasionally I'll call down for food. The guy will bring in the food. The respirator's going like crazy. The room is like steamed, you know, smelling like a eucalyptus tree. And I'm tired. I'm not feeling good. So the next day I go out and I'm feeling a little bit better, but really not that much better. And I come back to the room. And I go to get orange juice from the bar. And on the top of the bar is a package of vitamin B complex. Now, it wasn't on the bar before. And not a note or anything, just a thing of vitamin B complex. Now, I don't know whether it was the aide, whether it was the guy who brought my food, whether it was the woman who cleaned the room, whether it was the person who brought back my shirts. I don't know. I don't know who it was. I don't know what it was. But it was a very thoughtful thing. And I, you know, started taking this B complex, and I felt very taken care of, et cetera, and so forth. And so somebody did something that was genuinely nice. I mean, they noticed that here's this dead person in the room, you know. Maybe vitamin B will help him. But I will guarantee you, take my word for this, because I can give you other examples of the hotel in which all of the standard things that are supposed to be done, like wake you up on time, and, you know, the systems aren't working. So this was a discretionary act by a genuinely concerned person who probably didn't want me to die in the room. I don't know. You know, was afraid she'd have to wrap me up in a sheet and tow me out. But a genuine act of a person that you're touched by. But the hotel didn't have the capability to do that. Now, what do I mean by that? Mother Teresa, you know, did what she did. But the hotel doesn't receive any benefit from it. Now, hear what I mean by this. It was a genuinely fine thing to do. But the hotel doesn't build anything from that being done. Your people may do heroically fine things, discretionarily at the moment. But if your business can't do that consistently, that is, if you don't have a way to get it done, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't build your business. It doesn't give you any proprietary differentiation from anybody else. It doesn't give you the capacity to satisfy your customer because you can't repeat it. I had an extraordinary barber. I used to have an extraordinary barber. Extraordinary barber who decided customer service was going to be, you know, his thing. So he, you know, began to copy what some of the other guys were doing. And, you know, he'd have, would you care for a drink, Michael? And so, well, yeah, Antoine, you know, sure. What do you got, Michael? Whatever you want. You know, what would you like? Well, how about a Beck's beer? Oh, well, we don't have that, but what would you, you know, anything else? Well, we finally decided what I wanted. We finally got it, and he had it, and I got it, and I'm sitting there, and I'm having a drink. Antoine's doing, you know, this number, and I'm saying, geez, this is incredible. Antoine's really, you know, getting sophisticated. I mean, really thinking customers, you know, perceived needs. Lovely young lady he hired to come over and make sure that it was refilled every now and then. I mean, the guy's really going for it, you know. Next time I come in and I, you know, I sit down and I get relaxed waiting for my drink, and the lovely young lady who's going to come, I don't see her around anywhere. I said, Antoine, where's the young lady who brought me the drink the last time? He said, oh, she's gone. Well, did you replace her? No. She was more trouble than she was worth. What happened to the bar, Antoine? Oh, you want a drink? Yeah, well, I still have the bar. What would you like? Third time I come in, how'd you like some coffee? Right? This thing, you just see this thing going right down the pit. You understand what I'm saying? Pretty soon I'm asking him, hey, Anton, want to bring a cup of coffee next time I come? You know? You're looking a little tuckered out. You know? If you don't have the capability of doing this thing that you're going to decide to do in your business tonight. In other words, you're going to go back tonight and decide, what is this business you're about to create? What is the one singularly extraordinary thing your business needs to do in order to differentiate itself successfully so that 3 years from now, when you turn around to sell it, you can say, let me show you what my business does. You'll not believe it. But before you come to my building business, I'm going to give you the names of all our competition. Really, go there and visit them first. So what I'm saying is, go and visit everybody. I would ask them to go and visit everybody because I know what they're going to find because I visited everybody. You understand? So I visited everybody because I am positioning my business opportunity in relationship to those business opportunities, and I know what he's going to find when he comes here. So I want them to get all the comparisons out of the way. What would your business have to look like when it finally happens? And I'm suggesting, ladies and gentlemen, that you have got to do that, whether you're building it to sell it to somebody else or whether you intend to stay in it. Because if you intend to stay in it, this little sucker better work better than most businesses, because most businesses don't work at all. And this is the way you do that. So you ask the question, how does an extraordinary entrepreneurial mind build an extraordinary business? They do it in exactly the way I'm describing.
Who is my customer? Who is my employee? Who is my supplier? Who is my lender? What are their four categories of preference? What do I have to do in each of those four categories in order to provide them with the assurance that their frustrations will not only be alleviated, but they'll begin to gain satisfactions they didn't even think were possible? That's your job. That's the invention of this business. Your business is your product, nothing else. Your business is your product, nothing else. So let's talk about this organization chart and this organizational question. This is essentially the organization chart that we created at the outset of the program. And we had marketing, operations, and finance. And then we had sales and customer service and advertising research. I didn't deal with the operational components because they would vary depending upon your business. And then in the finance section, I talked about accounting, administration, and MIS. And then I asked that everybody put their name in the boxes that you effectively hold. And there was a titter, and you know, people began to identify the fact that they obviously are doing everything in the business. And when you begin to see how many jobs you actually have in your business, it becomes very, very apparent, very readily, why we struggle in our business. We struggle in our business because we have too much to do. Now, if you understand these to be essential things to do, meaning it's essential that marketing is a full-time operation in your business, that for your business to grow, for your business to achieve its potential, marketing is a full-time thing. It's not a part-time thing. I want you to imagine you had somebody whose energy, some very talented, capable, systematic, organized individual was focusing all of his or her attention on the marketing function. That's all they were doing. All his or her attention. 8 hours a day, 5, 6 days a week, all his or her attention on marketing. You imagine the impact that that would have, provided, of course, there was a system that was being produced as a result of that. If you have a marketing person who's sitting there focusing all of his or her attention on marketing and just making it up, making it up, making it up, making it up, explosively creative, always creative, all these original ideas, but you own nothing. Do you understand the problem inherent in that now rather than before you came in here? What's the problem? Problem is when that person leaves, you have to go out and get another new marketing person who's going to have totally different ideas, different ideas, different ideas, because that's what every original thinker always does. They always have different ideas from everybody else. So the first thing anybody would do would be to change your business because it's not their business. So effectively, for this to work, this marketing function has to build a marketing system. So the most extraordinary companies have done for years, years, one essential thing that continually produces. So the idea of continuous creativity is a myth. Continuous creativity is really not what the marketing function is there to do. The marketing function is there to help you to establish those most effective engines within your business that are predictably capable of producing this predictable growth that your company is looking for. And so the marketing function, obviously essential. Can you imagine how valuable it would be to have somebody in the operational function, full-time, focused only on operations? That is, if marketing is making the promise, operations is accountable for the fulfillment of that promise. Can you imagine how powerful it would be to have somebody totally focused, whose total accountability it was in your business, to achieve the development of a systematic process through which fulfillment is a natural course of events that whatever marketing says, operations can deliver. And finally, can you imagine your business somebody whose sole focus is the financial integrity of the business? Whose sole focus is the financial integrity of the business? So these are three essential functions. And can you imagine the integrator of all that? And the integrator of all that is the president of the company. So the president of the company is the integrator of these three forces, which are continually pulling apart. They're almost always seemingly at war with each other. Because operations is constantly asking marketing not to promise so much. And marketing is always asking operations to be more aggressive. And finance is asking both of them to shut up and leave them alone. Right? You want what? You want this? You want that? Money, money, money. Why don't you watch your business? Why don't you watch those cost overruns? Why don't you do the estimate? You know, I mean, finance is constantly nitty, nitty, nitty. So you can see this natural tension between these three functions. And it's a healthy organization within which you have that natural tension. The problem in our business is we don't. See, the problem in our businesses is because we do most of those things, or maybe two of them, or three of them, what happens is we don't produce that tension. And we don't produce that tension because the tension would be created within us. And so we don't sit there as the finance guy talking to ourselves as the marketing guy, or the operations guy sitting there talking to the finance guy. We don't have this dialogue. We make quick decisions. We make seat-of-the-pants decisions. We have no boss. There is no integrator. There's just the fragmenter, who is us. We're constantly fragmenting ourselves into activity, which is appealing, or if unappealing, we want to dispense with quickly. And so we don't have this natural healthy tension that needs to exist in every organization between these three essential functions. The tension pulls marketing back, pulls operations forward, and pulls all of them together to have a financial perspective of the financial implications of everything that we intend to do in our business. And when you have an organization chart, you can begin to see this diagrammatically. And so this tension is important. And organizing your business is really an organization of the tension. It's an identification of the work and an organization of the tension between these primary functions. What I'd like you to do with this organization chart, I want you to draw a line, a horizontal line, above the top box and leave some room above the horizontal line. So, because I want you to write something in it, above the president's box. We now have established and distinguished between inside the company and outside the company. We've now distinguished between inside the company and outside a company. Everything on the top of the box is outside the company. Everything below the box is inside the company. Above the line, I want you to draw in large, bold letters, owners. Owners. Now, this principle, ladies and gentlemen, if we have the ability to deal with this principle, if we can begin to play this game called business, if we can begin to create some rules for the game, if we're open to creating rules for the game, then something extraordinary can happen here. And the rule is this. When you go to work in the business, when you cross that line, you are no longer an owner, you're an employee. This is the rule. When you go to work in the business, I'm not talking on in right now. When you go to work in the business, when you cross that line, ladies and gentlemen, for your life's sake, you are no longer an owner. You are now an employee. Owners are outside of the business, and they become employees when they go inside the business. That means, for example, that when somebody asks you who you are, you say, I'm the president, or I'm the vice president of marketing. You don't say, I'm one of the owners. You don't say, I own this thing. You don't identify yourself as an owner. Now, why would you do that? Well, I'm going to give you three rules. For partners, for family businesses. For partnerships and for family businesses. For individually owned businesses. For your business. There are no more important rules than I can give you. Period. Other than, you know, talking on it, not in it, and all that stuff. I'm talking about now. The rules by which you establish this business and your interaction with each other. The first set of rules are called rules of relationship. Rules of relationship. The second set of rules are called rules of ownership. The third set of rules are called rules of employeeship. Now, I've called business a game, and I think it's obvious to everybody in the room that you can't play a game without rules. It is literally impossible to play a game without rules. Without rules, the game turns into anarchy. Anybody can claim they're the winner. Anybody can do any damn thing they please. You cannot run a business in any other way than as a game, and you cannot play a game without rules, which define the limits, the parameters, the authority, the accountability, what you can do and what you can't do in this game, in order for it to be this game. Well, what do I mean by rules of relationship? Okay, so now we start out. Rules of relationship precede everything. Because without rules of relationship, everything else goes crazy. Let me give you an example of rules of relationship. My wife once said to me, never embarrass me in front of other people. So the rule is, never embarrass me in front of other people. Now, that's a fairly open-ended rule. And I can begin to quibble. But let me tell you a rule about rules of relationship. Whatever the rule is, simply agree. Don't argue with it. Don't quibble about it. Don't say, well, I don't understand why you'd want that. Because you don't have to understand why she would want that. Just do it. That's the rule of relationship. Believing that because we're in relationship, we are going to, given the freedom to establish these rules, we're going to ask those things that are most important to us of the other. Because either they cause us pain or they cause us pleasure. We have no control over it. And so we establish a rule of relationship. Now we might begin to define what that means to gain some clarity to this rule. How do I embarrass you in front of other people? Well, let me give you an example. I can do something which creates the embarrassment in her. That creates a feeling of pain. Now, we can, as they say, quibble about it, and we can discuss it, and then I can say, well, it's really your problem, and so forth and so on. I'm saying that's the kind of crap psychology gets us into. Fact is, woman's embarrassed. I drop my pants, she feels embarrassed, right? I either choose to continue to drop my pants and say, get it handled, right, which is what we do. Get it handled, it's not my problem. Or I'm sensitive to the pain that's coming from her in this moment. And that sensitivity to the pain that's coming from her in this moment is what relationship is all about. It's an understanding. I'm trying to establish rules that are easy. And when I say that they're easy, because this is the pre-ownership phase. It's like we're in ownership, and now we're going to go back and establish rules of relationship. I'm saying we're starting all over again. How do we create an environment within which we can all achieve maximum productivity, maximum effectiveness, maximum alignment with each other? No conflict. And I say no conflict, I don't mean that we're just going to be, you know, these dead individuals sitting in there, no action going on. But I'm saying, how do we set it up so it can work? So what are rules of ownership? Rules of ownership, for example, are the limits of authority. Owners will agree on the limits of authority. How decisions are made about the business. Now, we're not in the business yet. We're outside of the business. So these are strategic limits on how decisions are made and about the business. Decisions about what? Decisions about capital acquisition. Decisions about purchasing of equipment. Decisions about expanding the facilities. Decisions about whatever. There also need to be rules about how you get out of the business. So if your partner's in a business, you can create a hypothetical that 3 years from now it's possible I don't want to be in the business any longer. Well, the question becomes, how do I get out? In other words, how do you get out of your business? Can anybody here imagine that one partner may want to expand the business, have global visions, and another partner may have regional visions? That is, one partner may be significantly more entrepreneurial than the other partner. That one partner may want grand things and the other partner may want less grand things. And obviously, you're in line for a conflict, because neither can be satisfied. There needs to be a buy and sell agreement. And there has to be a vehicle through which that buy and sell agreement can be funded. And you need to think about that in advance. You need to ask the question in ownership, what happens if one of the partners dies? Do I want my partner's 14-year-old boy as a partner? Or do I want his wife or her husband as a partner? So you need to consider all of that before you even start the business. So rules of ownership are very, very, very critical. Because without rules of ownership, anything can happen and anything will. With the rules of ownership, at least you're establishing a game that you've come into agreement about. Other rules of ownership are, how do we, as owners, operate when we're in the business? And those become the rules of employeeship. So effectively, though, you need to come to agreement. When we go into the business, we must operate within rules of employeeship. So the rule of ownership is that when we go into the business, we're no longer owners. We're employees. And there's a fundamentally sound reason for that. Because if we regard ourselves as owners in the business, we're creating two classes of people in the business. That is, this class of people operates by rules that this class of people doesn't. This class of people, the owners qua employees, operate according to all kinds of rules that don't apply to us, the folk, in the business. And then turns into what? It's called us and them. Us and them. So it's an extraordinary, understand, when you go into the business and you're an owner of the business, the people in the business know you're an owner in the business. But effectively, if you operate as though you're not an owner, but an employee, within the standards that have been established for everyone in the business, the dignity and respect you gain from that active, intentional decision cannot be spoken too highly of. And so you need to create rules of employeeship. And you need to come to agreement as owners before you go into the business that you're going to operate within those rules. There's another reason for that. Because if, in fact, what you're doing is establishing a franchise prototype, a business you're going to sell, then you're thinking of yourself, in fact, only as temporarily filling positions within the company. Now, you all did the organization chart. You all see all the positions that you hold in that organization chart. Those are all positions you're intending to get out of. But while you're in them, you're operating within them as a model or as a template, as a pre-production prototype for the person you're going to replace yourself with. You're there to create a system solution to that particular role in the business. This is how we do it here in this particular role in the business. This is how we sell it here. This is how we deliver it here. This is how we answer the phone. If you're the owner working in your business as an employee in a particular position, doing the tactical work of that position, your true role is twofold. Working in it as the salesperson, working on it as the vice president of marketing, to create a system solution so that when you finally replace yourself, you're replacing yourself with a person who now has the advantage of learning from what you have created. That is, they can now produce identically the same results that you could. And then you move out of the box. Now, what are rules of employeeship? Well, we'll talk about rules of employeeship when we get to these position contracts. But essentially, you can understand what rules of employeeship would be. Rules of employeeship, for example, could be that we have a dress code, that we always wear a blue suit. You establish a position. This is who we are. You come to agreement about the position. This is who we are. And then you honor it until you come to agreement about a new position. The problem is we arrive at most of our positions accidentally. We don't intentionally decide upon a position. We don't in our business day after day. What we do comes about by accident. We dress how we feel. We say what we feel. We're doing everything by the seat of our pants. There's no intention behind most of the things that we do, and so there's no force. You take a position, ladies and gentlemen, and you begin the very act of differentiation. Because all the differentiation is one position in relationship to another. One position in relationship to another. Your job is to take a position. There needs to be a position taken. The organization chart begins to help you to do that. The standards that you begin to create for the operation of your business begins to help you do that. Oh, you're the guys who, oh, you're the guys who, oh, you're the guys who. If people are not saying that about you, you can't understand. You can't understand deeply enough the price you're paying for it. Oh, you're the guys who, oh, you're the guys who, oh, you're the guys who. Oh, you're the guys who. All of these things that we're doing here is to organize this business in such a way that effectively you begin to create standards of operation, standards of relationship, standards of the game, rules of the game that effectively distinguish you, differentiate you from everybody else. And there's only one place to be differentiated, and that's in the minds of people.